Basically, I'm going to zip through now what is the conventional sensor network paradigm for which we see most papers being produced on, and then much quicker than I'd intended, go through what's now in effect the SENS view, but also a fair number of other researchers. And then, in particular, spend some time on what are some of the new theory challenges. And along those lines, you put his finger on it in his question. It's models, okay, is really the fundamental question. So, here are some of the standard assumption sets that people use. So, it can be the first version is memory processing and sensing are all going to be cheap, but communications is going to cost you due to energy and various fundamental limits, and thus, when you're deploying large numbers of sensors, you concentrate in algorithms that limit communications. But still, a more extreme version of this set of assumptions is that for the sensors' nodes to be cheap, even the processing should be limited, and then you concentrate on algorithms that limit both processing and communications. And these are interesting problems because they're really hard, okay? And so there's been quite a bit of work that's been done, and the typical construct that people consider is that you have randomized type of deployments, don't worry too much about where the nodes are, and flat architectures because, well, it's more aesthetically pleasing. Okay. So that's really where a lot of work has been done, and I have to say that along with this are associated some very difficult hardware challenges. How do you really get things to be small, cheap, and reliable, all those things. And so that's also been an interesting challenge. And so, what are some of the nice things about dense flat networks? Well, you can explore how much redundancy you need in the communications. And so, there's a lot of papers in this domain. There's the whole question of data aggregation and distributed fusion, right? So, if communication is expensive, then you want to do the processing as close to the sensor source as possible and squeeze things down. And this brings up a whole set of problems in rate distortion coding combined with networking. And it's really quite a bit of fun. There's scalability questions. Can such a network scale? Well, yes and no. It kind of depends on the assumptions you've made regarding the propagation conditions and the correlations in the source and a number of other assumptions. And density, reliability, accuracy trades are kind of where we end up with a lot of this stuff. There's also a question of, well, if the nodes cooperate, how much could the communication improve? And it turns out somewhat, but not really enough to overcome a lot of the fundamental scalability issues. And then there's the whole set of trades between adaptive fidelity, which is to say, you want to characterize the field spatially to a certain extent, where you can turn off nodes and extend the lifetime of the network and play a game where you trade your fidelity of reconstruction against the lifetime of the network. One can similarly play this type of game in the communications that nodes sort of cycle through, who's going to do the relaying and thereby extend the lifetime of the network. So this is all in this resource-constrained type of situation that Manny went over quickly. So, what applications, though, could we reasonably apply a large randomly deployed dense network to? Well, this was originally conceived in the context of short-term military deployments, and in such a situation, you could imagine that leaving heavy metals scattered throughout the environment would be okay, because they do that when they shoot up tanks with depleted uranium bullets. But it isn't really something you want to do in other situations. Okay. And another reason that this story was plausible for the military is that detection of vehicles with simple sensors like seismic, simple geophones, accelerometers, and the like is actually quite plausible. Okay. You can definitely do it. Detection of personnel is also possible. And in fact, if you're going to detect personnel at all, it has to be an extremely dense network. Okay. So there's compelling reasons to go in this direction. But the deployment reality has been different. Okay, and first of all, so DARPA did a big deployment with 1,000 nodes or more in Florida in a flat field. And it turned out that it was hierarchical, and they laid things out in a grid. And because of, even in that those conditions, the radio propagation issues were difficult with the cheap radios close to the ground. Okay, so, and the other thing that's unfortunate for the sensor network story for military is that vehicles are easy to detect by aerial surveillance. Okay, they kick up clouds of dust. You can track them on roads by their heat signatures and all kinds of stuff. And we now have Predator drones and much smaller, in fact, UAVs than there were in the mid-90s that are capable of these kinds of things. So what we're really interested in military applications is not detection of vehicles. We're interested in personnel and what they intend to do. And that, you're not going to get that from a vibration sensor or even a sequence of vibration sensors. You're going to need pictures. And so you have to move away from simply having these simple sensors, which could still play a role in detecting in the first place, is there something of interest? But they would be just one tier. And then, as Manny mentioned, the science applications diverge even more in the type of requirements. And so my basic story is that we don't have to abandon the version one set of theory problems because they're still interesting, but it is as one tier of a larger system. And the interesting component will, in fact, be how does it integrate with those things. So one area of theory that's, I believe, really fundamental is this whole question of sampling. So if your basic goal is to enable new science or to discover things about military personnel, then you're after discovering things that you don't know in the first place, and for which there's quite poor models about how things are going to behave, or you wouldn't really be doing the experiment in the first place. Okay? If you knew everything, you wouldn't need to bother with this. And you're going to do this at unprecedented scales. So I think the story of lots of sensors still plays. Okay? It's just that. It's modified into a larger system context. And a basic issue, of course, is, as Manny pointed out, is this question of data. You want to get reliable data. And there's lots of reasons to do this. It's to measure the phenomena, build models about this phenomena, even if you haven't, refine these models, validate or reject different models based on this data. And it can also be, as part of this, validate models about the system that you're deploying to see is it reliable or not. Okay? And so this all gets mixed in together. And then these questions of where to measure, how to measure, and a lot of problems in embedded network systems design are related to this sampling, coverage, deployment, time synchronization, data dissemination, do we have enough nodes, all these types of things. Okay? And so it's a very rich set of problems. And so there's a couple of historical ways that have been proposed for doing the sampling. One is, so this is version one sensor network, just over deploy. Okay, so, and then you would then focus on scheduling what nodes are on at a particular time so that you can extend network lifetime or sort of adaptively match to where the interesting things are happening in the field. So that's one version. And another version is to actuate. So you have things that move, so they're at some smaller density, but they follow orbits that are perhaps adaptive to, you know, see the things that you're interested in. Okay. And then, of course, there's a hybrid mix of these things, where you can have the static nodes do some observations which trigger where the mobile nodes go, or indeed the mobile nodes could drop off static nodes in particular locations so that you could dwell where the phenomenon is interesting and then pick them up later on as things sort of change. So there's a really interesting set of experiments that can be done in that type of domain. So, as mentioned, there's early sensor network focused on resource-constrained nodes in a flat architecture, but when you really think about it, the application set for high-density deployments is kind of limited, okay, if that's all you're doing, particularly if the sensors are to be inexpensive. And an issue Manny briefly touched on is the software question once you get to constrained platforms. So CS students are not unhappy programming in Linux. Okay, fact. Given the choice between that and anything else, Linux is it, you know. But Linux on a 2-cent Moog isn't happening. Okay, so that in itself, and if you think about any project development, even if it starts out being hardware-oriented, 90% of the effort is in the software. Okay, and so just from the realities of university research, you want to over-provision the memory and over-provision the processor so that you can recruit students who will actually do the work for you. So that's, I believe, a big part of it. Now, it's not to say that you can't develop some hybrid platforms that include some write once ASICs and some FPGAs and other stuff like that in it, but then we're already talking about a fairly expensive kind of thing. And so it's really, software, I think, is a huge issue. The other thing is that when you deal with scientists, they're very greedy people, okay? They tell you, I want this. Okay, they make you believe that they'll be happy if they get that. They're momentarily happy when they have that, okay? And then shortly afterwards, they're unhappy and they want more, okay? Which then cycles us back to this, because that's going to be a software change, okay, for you to be able to retask it. So science experiments are actually iterations. You're never going to do just one. You're going to do a sequence of them. And so you need to think about, it's great for an information theory kind of audience, you need to think about the sequence of experiments that you plan your system to be working on. And that also pushes you away from simply from using non-reprogrammable elements. And then another thing is logistics. And scientists like to know where the nodes are. Exactly. Okay. And so, and they have to come out by the time you're done. And then there's other issues like property owners that you need to negotiate with. And do you really want to be trampling through environmentally sensitive areas again and again and again? Okay. So there's lots of issues related to logistics, and this is a big part of the optimization. Now, the original vision of static nodes implicitly included logistics. They were thrown out of an airplane or some other such story, okay? But, or they were placed by someone. So there was mobility in the story as well. These were graduate students or soldiers who were supplying all the mobility. But these things need to be thought about within the optimization problem, okay? They're an integral part of it. In whichever layer of this hierarchy you're thinking about. And I won't beat this dead horse. Manny has flogged it sufficiently. And then, so the story, of course, is that it drives you towards some type of tiered architecture that involves mobility, whether it's mobility supplied by people or robotic elements. So, some theory problems. Manny talked quite a bit about the data integrity problem, and from a theory point of view, I think a really interesting question is the sufficiency of network components and measurements to trust the results, which then connects to item number two, what kind of model do you have to the different components that you're dealing with? And there's uncertainty in many aspects of your models. There's, as you said, you know, if you have a very precise model, you can get by with a smaller number of measurements because then you can interpolate among them using this. And that's particularly true if you can trust the data coming from your individual sensors. But if you have some uncertainty either in the data that's being produced or in the model of the physical phenomenon, then you are forced to have a more redundant deployment, which could take the form of redundancy in time. We do a sequence of experiments that establish some level of trust in these different models. Or it could be over space, that we have a more redundant deployment and see what's going to happen. I'm going to mainly talk about the model uncertainty and the next question, the multi-scale sensing, where there's also very interesting questions that once you start talking about multiple sensing modes, they inherently have different ranges that they're useful, and they're dealing with different physical models. And these, there's some intersection between them in telling you something about the phenomenon. But how do you link this information? What is the right density of nodes to use at these different levels? How should they be placed? How should they adaptively move based on this information? It's a very kind of rich set of questions. And then another point along these lines is that once one starts talking about this hierarchical sort of structure, the local interactions assume much bigger importance. So we become less concerned with, well, how are we going to integrate thousands of sensors across a flat network, and more interested in this locality where I have a bunch of simple sensors and then these more important sensors that we communicate to them. How do the information flows go? How do I determine how many I should have of each type in this region, and how should I adapt? And then, of course, there's the whole logistics management question. There's notions of energy mules, which could be undergraduates or graduate students, okay? Or mobile and fixed nodes to do these kinds of things and various trades among these types of items. So I think all of these have really interesting theory associated with them. Well, on to models. So here's kind of a partial list of modeling questions that we can be concerned with that are actually all pretty difficult. So in source phenomena, you get very different answers whether you start the model of what's going on assuming that one has a discrete set of, say, point sources that are responsible for the field that you're observing, okay? Or you say it's some kind of continuous phenomenon. You end up with different conclusions in the asymptotics between those two assumptions. There's the issue of the coupling to the medium. You may think that you're observing the phenomenon itself, but actually you may not be. You may simply be observing the fact that you didn't properly bury your seismometer, okay? And you end up with a very different result. There's the propagation medium itself, which is usually more interesting than a first model would indicate. And then, of course, all the noise and interference processes that as you do a more detailed measurement, you'll necessarily need more detailed models about what's going on in that domain. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of sensor transduction, where this is kind of why you can pay a lot of money for sensors, because the issues of how it couples to the medium, this conversion to electrical signals, how it drifts in response to related things like temperature, pressure, or other stuff, other than what you're directly measuring, well, you can partly compensate for a lot of those things by having additional sensors in a package and see what happens with it. But often they don't do that. And usually, if you're going to scale to large numbers, it's not going to be within your price range. And so that then leaves you with a nonlinear model for what's going on and with more free parameters than you might be happy with. So that's another interesting thing. And then, of course, there's more less sort of physical things. How do we transform to reduce representations? Fusion among the diverse sensor types. I think this has deep problems associated with this. And then the reliability of the components and how long we store and transport data at these different levels of abstractions that we're dealing with so that we get what we want while using a minimum of resources in the network. So that's a pretty big agenda, just in sort of the model domains. And of course, there's lots of sources of uncertainty. As you go through this, there's uncertainty in the observations and data, or data. And it's due to many sources. there's a question of what model parameters you can use, and I completely agree with what you said on this point, that it really depends on what measuring means you have at your disposal as to what model you're going to select. Complicated. Do you actually have enough measurements to justify a model of a particular level of complexity? So, and then questions of what models do you use for a different thing. This also depends on how much you know in the first place about what's going on and what sensing means you have at your disposal. Something I left out of here is sort of the whole general question of learning. Okay, so there's a big difference in doing an experiment to verify among some finite set of models and learning what the model should actually be. There's orders of magnitude difference in the amount of data you're going to have to get between the two possibilities. And then, of course, the goals and system interactions. There's a lot of uncertainty. Often when we do a theory paper, we know perfectly well what the goal is. It's to get it published, okay? But when you start dealing with scientists, as I mentioned earlier, their goals shift with time, okay? And so when you think about devising a whole experimental regime, okay, it's a system that's going to operate for some period of time, you have to think somewhat about what is the global set of goals that are going to have to be accommodated, okay? And so, of course, with any given instantiation of the experiment, you know what's going to happen, but your system is some type of compromise. And once you say that, you start ending up with more complexity in the system. So, as examples of model and data uncertainty problems, you can ask, for example, how much information is required to trust either the data or the model? And so one could, for example, have an auditor node that moves among some nodes that are seeing somewhat correlated information. You can ask questions, well, how close does it need to get to them so that I can calibrate? What sort of trajectory should it follow through so I minimize, say, the amount of time and energy I put into this auditor node? How closely should these be spaced so that I can figure this out? What sort of level of redundancy do I need, given I know the model to a given level of certainty? All these kinds of questions. And on the other side, there's sort of the model uncertainty. How many nodes my sample, a field to determine, is caused by one or more point sources? Okay, that's an example of a type of question that you could ask. Or you could ask quite other, a lot of other types of questions. So, here's just a few problems to go through this, and actually I should speed up. So, it's no surprise to anyone that validation is usually the most painful phase of any design process, right? And you can never exhaustively test. And so the question is, how can you trust the result given all the uncertainties that are left? And so how do we usually do this? What you do is you reuse someone else's either model, some other piece of theory, some piece of code, or some piece of hardware that's already been tested, proven out, and so on. And what you do is you minimally modify. Okay, so you add some new component, and that's where you focus on your validation effort. That's where really most of the stuff, most of the effort goes. And so if you think about it, well, this suggests that what you should be doing is some type of modular design. You're looking to put together components, and then you focus on the interconnections among these components as the places where things will break. And that's usually what we do. And then you can ask the question, but is this modular model design efficient? Okay? And usually the answer is no. Okay? If you were to crash through all the layers and do an all-in-one, one-purpose design, you can certainly write a paper showing that that is more efficient than doing this alternative approach. But then if you can ask an alternative question, is it efficient in terms of design time? Okay, well, absolutely. And so what sort of metric are we going to apply to this for, you know, our results to be useful. So I think there needs to be some notion of validation effort when someone proposes a design as being efficient. And that's related to the number of uses to which you intend a system to be put. Okay, if it's just one use, one thing, that's kind of a bright line, then go for it, do the ASIC, do all those kinds of things. But if it's to be two, it's never two. It's always, once you do two, you agree that it's going to be more. Because actually this story was told to me by a priest with regard to affairs. So experience, you know, people who came to confess, if it was one affair, possibly believable. If it was two, it might as well be infinity, because it soon will be. So I think it's similar for applications. Once you're tempted by more than one. So I think quantifying the efficiency versus validation effort trade-off, I think, is a really sort of interesting thing in model creation. And so I've more or less done this. This is how we always do things, right? So you begin with what you know, you validate a more efficient procedure, you bake off the rival designs or hypotheses using your favorite measure of fitness, and then you iterate, and you end up with a cost.
Well, it is really depressing.
Well,
innovative little effort.
Yes. The reason is that you have finite time. And why it's not completely depressing is that innovating even a little is really hard. Okay, so getting anything to work, right? Nearly impossible. So if you set up too ambitious a goal to begin with, you're guaranteeing failure, right? So this is the standard approach to design. There's really nothing new there. Pardon?
You're still in a university, actually.
Well, but even so, right? Let's suppose NSF were to shower money on you.
Okay.
So then you could hire all the graduate students you want, and you could pursue all your favorite design dreams, right? But they never do that. So, you know, if you're going to get a system to work, or even a theoretical construct, you have to build on pieces that other people have done. And so what's then needed is a theoretical framework that allows you to integrate all these components together. And just to take an example of how we do things in models, right? So I'm an electrical engineer, and so Maxwell, he's the god of electrical engineering, right? And so he has equations that describe our universe. And you could always reason things through using Maxwell's equations. But what's really cool about it is there's an economy of principles, but unfortunately it is computationally intractable for large volumes, right? And so the other sad fact about Maxwell's equations is that there's many parameters that have to be empirically determined. So a permittivity of the soil. Well, it's nice that it's one number, except that this one number changes. Okay, it changes with time, it changes with location, and by the time you did all the experiments, you'd never get any. Okay, if you're trying to do it with a big volume, or even for this room, impossible. If you're going to do things at a particular level of precision, at some point, you're going to be up against it. And so the practical approach is basically you do some sort of hybrid models. And so for Maxwell, what you start with is geometric models, what everyone sees in high school, right? So rays, plus Huygens' principle for spreading of wave fronts. And then you add some statistical models for the things that you can't deal with. Which statistical models you choose is informed by the geometrical factors, and then deeper investigations as required, okay, as you need to deal with things. And so the level of detail in the model, of course, depends on your goals. And so we build up layered models. And that's how we do reality. It's a series of models, different layers of abstractions, linkages among them. Okay, and so simple is, for example, a two-level model where in each level of the hierarchy you have a trusted or a reference experiment, something that someone has done before, and serves as a measure of trust or model, any number of things. And then this higher level establishes some context so that you can select among these possible models, and then you can proceed in this way. Since I'm an information theorist, then build this into an N level type of construction, these different levels of abstraction. And you can apply standard tools, reuse components, and limit the validation to the new things. As an example, I'm actually going to quickly go through this, that we dealt with a two-level model of a camera and a laser mapper to provide context and wider area coverage, and then to have a direct measurement of the incident light intensity as the lower level. And the idea is that you wouldn't have to then do these direct measurements over the whole sample volume. You could use those to validate or calibrate what was happening with this sort of indirect measure of reflected of intensity from the reflected light, and to gauge what the intensity would then be over a larger area. And so this is the basic setup that you have indeed one source, sunlight, but then you have the scatterer, a tree. And the tree is pretty complicated because it's dynamic, right? The leaves move. Furthermore, the sun moves and branches move. And the ground that you're examining is inhomogeneous, right? And so there's lots of fun that can be done in this. And of course, the camera response is nonlinear, and there's all kinds of calibration questions and so on. So even in a very simple thing of, say, trying to get light intensity with a sort of a two-level design, there's a lot of complexity and, I think, interesting questions. So, and then, of course, we go to NLS, right? So, and try to extend to larger geographic regions. And this is the alternative, basically, to doing a dense deployment over the entire surface of the Earth. That's sentence, right? What you would do is locally dense deployments, learn models, and then use broader area sensing modalities to try to then extend to larger regions. And so I've already talked about this, more or less. But I just wanted to mention that the traditional approach of a sequential set of experiments allows the management of uncertainty of each step, which minimizes your marginal effort, and it naturally lends itself to a Bayesian approach, which then has the double advantage of a direct connection to information theory. So what's nice about a Bayesian type of framework is that it directly allows you to account for uncertainties, and it allows you to do data fusion among vastly different types of sensor nodes that are involved in your network. And it also allows you to incrementally improve the model as time goes along, because you can reduce the uncertainty as you go forward. And so the problem with a sequence of experiments is that there's an overhead in terms of the requirements of, you know, particularly needed at a, say, for a given experiment that you're doing. But there's really, in my view, not another practical way of going at these kinds of things. Because doing a complete experimental design for something as complicated as one of Tom's rivers just isn't going to make it. Okay? It has to be something that you build up over time if you're going to understand a complicated phenomenon. So to conclude, I think things really are moving towards these multi-layered systems, multi-layered not just in the sense of the physical devices that you're using, but also multiple levels of abstraction for bringing this information together. And with that, I'll stop.